This is Audible.
Bantam Doubleday Dell Audio presents How the Irish Saved Civilization, Unabridged, by Thomas Cahill. Narrated by Donald Donnelly.
Introduction. How real is history? The word Irish is seldom coupled with the word civilization. When we think of peoples as civilized or civilizing, the Egyptians and the Greeks, the Italians and the French, the Chinese and the Jews may all come to mind. The Irish are wild, feckless and charming, or morose, repressed and corrupt, but not especially civilized. If we strain to think of Irish civilization, no image appears. No fertile crescent or Indus Valley. No brooding Buster Beethoven. The simplest Greek auto mechanic will name his establishment Parthenon, thus linking himself to an imagined ancestral culture. A semi-literate restaurateur of Sicilian origin will give pride of place to his plaster copy of Michelangelo's David, and so assert his presumed Renaissance ties. But an Irish businessman is far more likely to name his concern the Breathney Bar, or Kelly's Movers, announcing a merely local or personal connection, unburdened by the resonances of history or civilization. And yet, Ireland, a little island at the edge of Europe, that has known neither Renaissance nor Enlightenment, in some ways a third world country with, as John Betjeman claimed, a Stone Age culture, had one moment of unblemished glory. For, as the Roman Empire fell, as all through Europe matted, unwashed barbarians descended on the Roman cities, looting artifacts and burning books, the Irish, who were just learning to read and write, took up the great labour of copying all of Western literature, everything they could lay their hands on. These scribes then served as conduits through which the Greco-Roman and Judeo-Christian cultures were transmitted to the tribes of Europe, newly settled amid the rubble and ruined vineyards of the civilization they had overwhelmed. Without this service of the scribes, everything that happened subsequently would have been unthinkable. Without the mission of the Irish monks, who single-handedly refounded European civilization throughout the continent in the bays and valleys of their exile, the world that came after them would have been an entirely different one. A world without books. And our own world would never have come to be. Not for 1,000 years. Not since the Spartan legion had perished at the hot gates of Thermopylae had Western civilization been put to such a test or faced such odds. Nor would it again face extinction till in this century it devised the means of extinguishing all life. As our story opens at the beginning of the 5th century, no one could foresee the coming collapse. But to reasonable men in the second half of the century, surveying the situation of their time, the end was no longer in doubt. Their world was finished. One could do nothing but, like Ausonius, retire to one's villa, write poetry, and await the inevitable. It never occurred to them that the building blocks of their world would be saved by outlandish oddities from a land so marginal that the Romans had not bothered to conquer it, by men so strange they lived in little huts on rocky outcrops, and shaved half their heads, and tortured themselves with fasts and chills and nettle baths. As Kenneth Clark said, looking back from the great civilizations of 12th-century France or 17th-century Rome, it is hard to believe that for quite a long time, almost 100 years, Western Christianity survived by clinging to places like Skellig Michael, a pinnacle of rock 18 miles from the Irish coast, rising 700 feet out of the sea. Clark, who began his Civilization with a chapter called The Skin of Our Teeth, on the precarious transition from classical to medieval, is an exception in that he gives full weight to the Irish contribution. Many historians fail to mention it entirely, and few advert to the breathtaking drama of this cultural cliffhanger. This is probably because it is easier to describe stasis, classical then medieval, than movement, classical to medieval. It is also true that historians are generally expert in one period or the other, so that analysis of the transition falls outside their and everyone's competence. At all events, I know of no single book now in print that is devoted to the subject of the transition, nor even one in which this subject plays a substantial part. In looking to remedy this omission, we may as well ask ourselves the big question. How real is history? Is it just an enormous soup, so full of disparate ingredients that it is uncharacterizable? Is it true, as Emile Choran has remarked, that history proves nothing because it contains everything? Is it not the reverse side of this, that history can be made to say whatever we wish it to? I think, rather, that every age writes history anew, reviewing deeds and texts of other ages from its own vantage point. Our history, the history we read in school and refer to in later life, was largely written by Protestant Englishmen and Anglo-Saxon Protestant Americans. Just as certain contemporary historians have been discovering that such redactors are not always reliable when it comes to the contributions of, say, women or African Americans, we should not be surprised to find that such storytellers have overlooked a tremendous contribution in the distant past that was both Celtic and Catholic, a contribution without which European civilization would have been impossible. To an educated Englishman of the last century, for instance, the Irish were, by their very nature, incapable of civilization. "The Irish," proclaimed Benjamin Disraeli, Queen Victoria's beloved Prime Minister, "hate our order, our civilization, our enterprising industry, our pure religion." Disraeli's father had abandoned Judaism for the Church of England. "This wild, reckless, indolent, uncertain, and superstitious race have no sympathy with the English character. Their ideal of human felicity is an alternation of clannish broils and coarse idolatry," i.e., Catholicism. "Their history describes an unbroken circle of bigotry and blood." The venomous racism and knuckle-headed prejudice of this characterization may be evident to us, but in the days of "dear old Dizzy," as the Queen called the man who had presented her with India, it simply passed for indisputable truth. Occasionally, of course, even the smug colonists of the little Queen's Empire would experience a momentary qualm. Could the conquerors possibly be responsible for the state of the colonized? But they quickly suppressed any doubt and wrapped themselves in their impervious superiority. As in this response by the historian Charles Kingsley to the famine-induced destitution he witnessed in Victorian Ireland. "I am daunted by the human chimpanzees I saw along that 100 miles of horrible country. I don't believe they are our fault." Emphasis mine. "I believe that there are not only many more of them than of old, but that they are happier, better, and more comfortably fed and lodged under our rule than they ever were. But to see white chimpanzees is dreadful. If they were black, one would not feel it so much. But their skins, except where tanned by exposure, are as white as ours." Nor can we comfort ourselves that such thinking passed long ago from the scene. As the distinguished Princeton historian Anthony Grafton wrote recently in the New York Review of Books of history departments at the better American universities, "Catholic culture, like most Catholics, was usually disdained as the province of lesser breeds fit only for the legendary parochial schools, where nuns told their charges never to order ravioli on a date, lest their boyfriends be reminded of pillows. Stereotypes and prejudices of this kind, as nasty as anything fastened upon Jews, persisted in American universities until an uncomfortably recent date." That date may be only the day before yesterday. Yet this is not to accuse any historian of deliberate falsification. No, the problem is more subtle than deception, and artfully described by John Henry Newman in his fable of The Man and the Lion. The man once invited the lion to be his guest, and received him with princely hospitality. The lion had the run of a magnificent palace, in which there were a vast many things to admire. There were large saloons and long corridors, richly furnished and decorated, and filled with a profusion of fine specimens of sculpture and painting, the works of the first masters in either art. The subjects represented were various, but the most prominent of them had an especial interest for the noble animal who stalked by them. It was that of the lion himself. And as the owner of the mansion led him from one apartment into another, he did not fail to direct his attention to the indirect homage which these various groups and tableaux paid to the importance of the lion tribe. There was, however, one remarkable feature in all of them, to which the host, silent as he was from politeness, seemed not at all insensible. That diverse as were these representations, in one point they all agreed, that the man was always victorious, and the lion was always overcome. It is not that the lion has been excluded from the history of art, but rather that he has been presented badly, and he never wins. When the lion had finished his tour of the mansion, continues Newman, his entertainer asked him what he thought of the splendours it contained, and he, in reply, did full justice to the riches of its owner and the skill of its decorators. But he added, "Lions would have fared better had lions been the artists." In the course of this history, we shall meet many entertainers, persons of substance, who have their story to tell, some of whom may believe that their story is all there is to tell. We shall be gracious and give them a hearing without disparagement. We shall even attempt to see things from their point of view. But every once in a while, we shall find ourselves entertaining lions, at which moments it will be every reader for himself. We begin, however, not in the land of lions, but in the orderly, predictable world of Rome. For, in order to appreciate the significance of the Irish contribution, we need first to take an inventory of the civilized empire of late antiquity. Chapter 1. The End of the World. How Rome Fell and Why. On the last cold day of December, in the dying year we count as 406, the River Rhine froze solid, providing the natural bridge that hundreds of thousands of hungry men, women, and children had been waiting for. They were the Barbary. To the Romans, an undistinguished, matted mass of others. Not terrifying, just troublemakers, annoyances, things one would rather not have to deal with. Non-Romans. To themselves they were, presumably, something more. But as the illiterate leave few records, we can only surmise their opinion of themselves. Neither the weary, disciplined Roman soldiers ranked along the west bank, nor the anxious, helter-skelter tribes amassing on the east bank, could have been giving much thought to their place in history. But this moment of slack, this relative calm before the pandemonium to follow, gives us a chance to study the actors on both sides of this river, and to look backward on what has been, and forward to what will be. Ascending heavenward, like the Roman eagle, we can view the Rhine, widest river in Europe, rising out of Lake Constance in the northern Alps, bending and bowing north, then northwest, till, after 820 miles of travel, it reaches the coast of continental Europe and empties into the North Sea, just opposite the Thames estuary. Returning to our Alpine heights, we can spot another river, rising from a smaller lake just north of Constance, and coursing east for more than twice the length of the Rhine, till it spends itself in the Black Sea. This is the Danube, Europe's longest river after the Volga. To the north and east of these two Alpine rivers live the barbarians. To the south and west lies Romania, in its time the vastest and most powerful empire in human history. The omnipotence and immensity of this empire, embracing as it did the whole of the civilized world, are not the qualities that would strike us were we to soar above the Mediterranean on that fateful day. What we would discern is the very opposite of power, fragility, specifically geographic fragility. We live around a sea, the perspicacious Socrates had reminded his listeners, like frogs around a pond. For all the splendour of Roman standard, the power of Roman boot, and the extent of Roman road, the entire empire hugs the Mediterranean like a child's village of sand waiting to be swept into the sea. From fruitful Gaul and Britain in the north to the fertile Nile Valley in the south, from the rocky Iberian shore in the west to the parched coasts of Asia Minor, all provinces of the empire turn toward the great sea, toward Mediterranea, the sea of Middle Earth. And as they turn to the center of their world, they turn their back on all that lies behind them, beyond the Roman wall. They turn their back on the barbarians. That Rome should ever fall was unthinkable to Romans. Its foundations were unassailable, sturdily sunk in a storied past and steadily built on for 11 centuries and more. There was, of course, the prophecy. Someone, usually someone in his cups, could always be counted on to bring up that old saw. The prophecy of the 12 eagles. Each eagle representing a century, leaving us with stubby fingers counting out the decades in a puddle of wine. Only 70 years remaining. Give or take a decade. Predictable laughter at the silliness of the whole idea. But in 70 years exactly, the empire would be gone. Eternal Rome, 11 centuries old, hardly foresaw its doom. But theories about its fall are very old indeed. 2 dozen years after this Roman barbarian encounter along the Rhine, Augustine of Hippo, second city of Roman Africa, will be lying on his deathbed listening to the clamour of another wave of barbarians as they attack the walls of his city. He has barely finished the final pages of his great defence of Christianity, the City of God, written to contradict the Roman pagans who discerned behind the barbarian assaults the old gods of Rome angry at being forsaken by Christian converts. No, insists Augustine eloquently, it is not Christianity but vice-encumbered paganism that is bringing the empire down. 9 centuries later, as impressive feats of Roman engineering and sculpture are being dug up all over Italy at the dawn of the Renaissance, the question of what became of the cultural giants who built these things will be on everyone's lips. Petrarch, the Tuscan poet and scholar, who is rightly remembered as the father of Renaissance humanism, rediscovers the concept of a fall, which, following Augustine's lead, he blames on the empire's internal faults. Machiavelli, writing 150 years later, in a less spiritual, more cynical time, will blame the barbarians. When the first volume of Edward Gibbon's The History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire appeared in 1776, it raised far more lively interest in London than the news from the troublesome colonies in North America. The decline of Rome, wrote Gibbon, was the natural and inevitable effect of immoderate greatness. Such a perception fits well with the cool and rational temper of the time. but as the more conventional English gentleman of the late 18th century continued to turn the pages of Mr. Gibbon's discourse, their blood began to boil. "As the happiness of a future life is the great object of religion," he continued, "we may hear without surprise or scandal that the introduction, or at least the abuse, of Christianity had some influence on the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. The clergy successfully preached the doctrines of patience and pusillanimity. The active virtues of society were discouraged. And the last remains of the military spirit were buried in the cloister. A large portion of public and private wealth was consecrated to the specious demands of charity and devotion, and the soldier's pay was lavished on the useless multitudes of both sexes who could only plead the merits of abstinence and chastity." Shock was registered and rebuttals issued, and Mr. Gibbon hastened to defend himself in his vindication. But in truth, his theory was no novelty, being scarcely distinguishable from the pagan theory Augustine had taken up the cudgels against more than 13 centuries earlier. Nor was it devoid of merit. Still, it is helpful to know a little of Gibbon's own history. At 16, an intense convert to Catholicism, packed off to Switzerland by his outraged father, where he was reconverted to Protestantism, this time of the Calvinist variety, and almost simultaneously to the uncompromising scepticism of Voltaire, whom he met. The permanent effect on the mature man of so many, and contradictory, youthful passions may easily be guessed. These earlier interpreters, first the pagan critics of Christianity, then Augustine, Petrarch, Machiavelli, and Gibbon, have defined the limits of all later interpretations. Rome fell because of inner weakness, either social or spiritual. Or, Rome fell because of outer pressure, the barbarian hordes. What we can say with confidence is that Rome fell gradually, and that Romans for many decades scarcely noticed what was happening. Clues to the character of the Roman blindness are present in the scene along the frozen Rhine. The legionnaires on the Roman bank know that they have the upper hand, and that they always will have. Even though some are only half-civilized recruits recently settled on this side of the river, they are now Romans, inheritors of nearly 12 centuries of civilization, husbandry, agriculture, viniculture, horticulture, cuisine, arts, literature, philosophy, law, politics, martial prowess, and all the gear and tackle and trim that goes with these pursuits. The world has never known anything as deep, as lasting or as extensive as Pax Romana, the peace and predictability of Roman civilization. Inspecting the Roman soldiers now, we note the quiet authority of their presence, the polish of their person, the appropriateness of their stance. They are spiffy. More than this, there is an aesthetic to each gesture and accoutrement. All details have been considered ad unguem, as they would say, to the fingertip. As a sculptor tests the smoothness and perfection of his finished marble. Their hair is cut with a thought to the shape of the head. They are clean-shaven to show off the resoluteness of the jawline. Their dress, from their impregnable but shapely breastplates to their easy movement skirts, is designed with the form and movement of the body in mind, and their hard physiques recall the proportions of Greek statuary. Even the food in the mess is prepared to be not only savory to the taste, but attractive to the eye. Just now, the Architriclinus, the chef, is beginning to prepare the carrots. He slices each piece lengthwise, then lengthwise again, to achieve slender, elongated triangles. We look out across the river to the barbarian hosts, who, in the slanting grey light of winter, mass like figures in a nightmare. Their hair, both of head and face, is uncut, vilely dressed with oil, braided into abhorrent shapes. Their bodies are distorted by ornament and discoloured by paint. Some of the men are huge and muscular to the point of deformity, their legs wrapped comically in the garments called brocci, breeches. There is no discipline among them. They bellow at each other and race about in chaos. They are dirty and they stink. A crone in a filthy blanket stirs a cauldron, slicing roots and bits of rancid meat into the concoction from time to time. She slices a carrot crosswise up its shaft, so that the circular pieces she cuts off float like foolish yellow eyes on the surface of her brew. This unequal portrait of the two forces would not only have been the Roman view, it could almost have been the German view as well, for the milling hosts are of Germanic origin, as are all the intruders of this period. To the Romans, the German tribes were riffraff. To the Germans, the Roman side of the river was the place to be. The nearest we can come to understanding this divide may be the southern border of the United States. There, the spit and polished troops are immigration police. The hordes, the Mexicans, Haitians, and other dispossessed peoples seeking illegal entry. The barbarian migration was not perceived as a threat by Romans, simply because it was a migration, a year-in, year-out, raggle-taggle migration, and not an organized armed assault. It had, in fact, been going on for centuries. The Gauls had been the first barbarian invaders, hundreds of years before, and now Gaul lay at peace. The verses of its poets and the products of its vineyards were twin fountains of Roman inspiration. The Gauls had become more Roman than the Romans themselves. Why could not the same thing happen to these Vandals, Alains, and Suevs, now working themselves to a fever pitch on the far side of the river? When at last the hapless Germans make their charge across the bridge of ice, it is head-on, without forethought or strategy. With preposterous courage, they team across the Rhine in convulsive waves, their principal weapon, their own desperation. We get a sense of their numbers, as well as their desperation, in a single casualty count. The Vandals alone are thought to have lost 20,000 men, not counting women and children, at the crossing. Despite their discipline, the Romans cannot hold back the Germanic sea. From one perspective at least, the Romans were overwhelmed by numbers. Not just in this encounter, but during centuries of migrations across the porous borders of the empire. Sometimes the barbarians came in waves, though seldom as big as this one. More often they came in trickles, as craftsmen who sought honest employment, as warriors who enlisted with the Roman legions, as tribal chieftains who paid for land, as marauders who burned and looted, and sometimes raped and murdered. What set them on the move was agriculture, which they had learned from their Roman neighbors. As the barbarian societies to the north of the empire turned from the nomadic ways of the hunter to the settled ways of the farmer, a seasonally predictable store of grain caused the inevitable population explosion. For all too obvious reasons, farmers live longer lives and see far more of their young reach adulthood than do hunters, whose precarious lives and those of their progeny are lived like an ecological high-wire act played without a net. For farmers, the safety net is the grain supply, more food than they need right now. This ancient form of money in the bank has served from time immemorial as the basis for long life, long-term planning, and all the arts of civilization. But the complete formula is as invariable as it is archaic. Economic success in the form of a store of grain triggers a population explosion, which quickly triggers the need to acquire new land to feed new mouths. 11 centuries prior to the encounter on the Rhine, an insignificant band of Latin-speaking farmers had but recently settled down to fixed agriculture and solved the problem of rapidly growing numbers by embarking upon a career of conquest that ultimately eventuated in the Roman Empire, remarks the contemporary historian William MacNeill. Considered in this light, the Roman state in the West was destroyed by the same forces that had created it. MacNeill thus takes the sensible, need-based route of Machiavelli. But as the classical historians have shown us, there are other lights in which to consider this enormous transformation. Why was the border guard so thin? Did the Romans not notice, at some point, that their way of life was changing forever? Did they not think to do something about it besides bow to the inevitable? What were they thinking about? In order to answer these questions and gain a fuller picture of Roman society, we turn to a typical Roman who helped to build the world of late antiquity. The barbarian onslaught across the frozen Rhine occurred in the first decade of the 5th century. Let us step back a bit into the 4th century and meet a man whose style of life can show us some of the yawning absences in Roman society, absences that would lead directly to the calamities of the 5th century. He is Ausonius the poet, and he kept an impressively large, exquisitely maintained country estate in Bordeaux, in the province of Gaul, and, after his father's death, another equally impressive estate in Aquitaine. Born just 100 years before the German migration over the Rhine, he was raised not by his mother, of whom he doesn't seem to have had especially fond memories, but by two battle axes, a grandmother and an aunt, both named Emilia. In his Parentalia, which might best be translated Obsequies for the Forebears, he extols their virtues. Of grandmother Emilia, he recalls, Et non deliciis ignoscere prompta pudendis, od perpendiculum seque suosque hobuit. To questionable pleasures she gave no quarter, but held both herself and her household rigidly upright. The other, Emilia, seems to have been rather large. Emilia incunis hilari cognomen adepta, quod lita et pueri comis od effigiem, redibas verum non dissimulanter effebum. Emilia, nicknamed Lusty in your cradle, because you were as much fun as a boy, and, without trying, you always looked like a lad. The rhetorical progression we are meant to notice here takes us through three stages of growth in three lines of poetry. Infant, incunis, boy, pueri, and adolescent, effebum. Emilia, though strapping, never grows quite as big as a man. Something, however, does keep growing in Emilia. Aunt Emilia gets higher marks than grandmother Emilia, even if she must often have been severe toward the child Ausonius, who as a man designates her Virgo Devota, resolutely virginal. So resolute, in fact, that feminei sexus odium tibi semper et inde. Crivit devoti virginitatis amor. Hatred of the female sex forever grew within you, and from that sprang your love of consecrated maidenhood. Though I'm having some fun with this poetry, Ausonius is not. I am translating ambiguous lines to strengthen their ambiguity. Ausonius has surrounded these lines with conventional sentiments, no more fresh or interesting than what we might expect from a modern sympathy card. This, for instance, is how he ends the poem on his grandmother. Haec me præreptum cunis et ab ubere matris, blanda sub austeris imbuit in peris, tranquillos avii cineres praestate, quieti aeternum mones, si pia verba loquor. By such kindnesses did she rear me, ripped from cradle and mother's breast, but under the guise of stern commands. Let my grandmother's ashes rest in peace, ever silent shades, if I say the proper prayers. Ausonius's friends might have been expected to notice that this is faint praise, but only because his praise indirectly draws attention to himself. Ah, dear Ausonius, they would have been expected to sigh, those women were hard on him, yet he remained so good, so loyal, fulfilling all the rites. Pia verba, literally faithful words, as is expected of him. Ausonius's poetry is full of pia verba, except for the occasional, only half-intentional epiphanies, as in the poems about the Emilias. There is little else. There are endless sequences about forebears, about former teachers, about daily life, about classical subjects, the heroes of the Trojan War, the 12 Caesars, endless word games, and endless imitations of Virgil. He has one hot poem, Cento Nuptialis, hot enough to be left untranslated in the lobe, Ausonius, where it has titillated as many generations of aging Latinists as it has frustrated generations of schoolboys. A clinical, cynical description of a bride's deflowering on her wedding night. Yet even here he is deliberately unoriginal. Every phrase is taken from the poems of Virgil. Thus does he mean to avoid censure by appealing to the ultimate literary authority, and to win admiration by a dazzling display of his knowledge of Virgil. But, apart from these homages, there is almost never a memorable phrase, just high-class jingles written to formula. His letters, also endless, are no better. There is seldom any necessary information to be communicated. Insights are scarce, and genuine emotion is almost entirely absent. Though his effete contemporaries compared Ausonius to Virgil and Cicero, practically all others have found themselves in agreement with the robust opinion of Gibbon. The poetical fame of Ausonius condemns the taste of his age. How could a grown man have spent so much time so foolishly? Well, it's what everyone else was doing. This is a static world. Civilized life, like the cultivation of Ausonius's magnificent Bordeaux vineyards, lies in doing well what has been done before. Doing the expected is the highest value, and the second highest is like it, receiving the appropriate admiration of one's peers for doing it. Though Ausonius is a Christian convert, as his Oratio shows, his Christianity is a cloak to be donned and removed as needed. It was no doubt what everyone else was doing. His real world view glimmers through all his work, a sort of agnostic paganism that enables him to evoke the silent shades of the pagan underworld without ever giving the reader the sense that he believes in any world but this one. In Ausonius and all the other best people of the age, so like one another it is difficult to tell them apart, we see the flaw in Gibbon's analysis of Rome's fall. The vigorous gods of Rome were not eclipsed by some effeminate Eastern fantasy religion. Fecund Venus and bloody Mars did not vacate the field to the pathetic pacifist Christ. Rather, the life of the old religion had already drained away, and by the time Christianity came to the attention of the Roman gentry, the gods were shadows of their formerly lively selves. Marginal. Quieti mones. Rustling through a dimly viewed eternity. It is no accident that when we today think of the Danube and the Rhine, the two rivers that divided the civilized world from the world of the northern barbarians, what come to mind are not the ghostly gods of Rome, but the vigorous gods of the German tribes. Ausonius made his career as a grammaticus, a professor of Latin at Bordeaux, which then boasted one of the empire's great universities. His fame as a teacher reached even to the imperial court, and after 30 years in academe, he was summoned to the Golden Palace in Milan, for the royal family no longer resided at Rome, to become tutor to Gratian, son of Valentinian, Emperor of the West. When, in 368, Gratian was ordered to accompany his father on an anti-German campaign, Ausonius went along as a sort of poet laureate to the expedition, rising suitably to the occasion with his usual bland results. Though this is also the period of the barracks humour of the Cento Nuptialis, written, so Ausonius informs us, at the suggestion of the emperor himself. As one of his spoils of war, Ausonius won the services of a German slave girl, whose charms he sang in his Bissula sequence. Delicium blonditii ludus amor voluptas. Barbara, sed qui lotios, vincis alumna pupos. Morsel, blandishment, sport, desire, climax, barbarian. But you, kid, are ahead of all the Latin girls. It begins to sound like real poetry, with each noun alluding to the mounting tension of the poet's arousal, till, at the moment of orgasm, Barbara is moaned. But then you realize he's just aping Catullus. In 375, the boy, Gratian, reached the throne, sharing it with his brother, Valentinian II, on the death of their father, and it is at this point that Ausonius's star enters its empyrean. He becomes Quaestor Sacri Pilotii, a sort of chief of staff to the emperors. In the same year, his aged father, pushing 90, is named to the honorary post of Prefect of Illyricum. In the next, his son is made Proconsul of Africa. More honors tumble forth for father, for son-in-law, for nephew. And then, in 379, Ausonius is named Consul, the highest position any Roman, apart from the royal family, can attain. In the old days of Republican Rome, the consuls, there were two of them, so each could keep the other honest, elected for a term of 1 year to thus prevent dictatorship, had been the executive pinnacle of Roman government. But in the decisive sea battle of Actium in 31 BC, Octavian had defeated his fellow consul Mark Antony, who had soiled republican virtue by lolling with Cleopatra in Egypt. Nobly seizing the imperial power, Octavian became Augustus Caesar, the first emperor. And the consulships were henceforth transformed into honorary positions, vestigial reminders of republican virtue, and utterly ornamental. The consulships were not the only ornamental offices in Roman society. The eternal city was filled with the comings and goings of impotent men, senators, magistrates, bustling administrators of all kinds, performing meaningless duties. Augustus, while seizing all power, had wisely left in place all the republican trappings. The empty show that resulted only emphasized the more the importance of how things were done, since no one wished to advert to the vanity of what was being done. During the 4 centuries that elapsed from the time of Augustus to the time of Ausonius, the life of the capital turned ever more insubstantial and brittle, so that some ceremony or other, meticulously executed, could become the apogee of a man's life. In Ausonius's case, the ceremony